The Reconstructionist Radio Podcast Network presents Christian Reconstruction 101, Rebuilding the Foundations of Orthodox Christianity and Establishing the Kingdom of God Through the Discipling of the Nations.
Welcome back to Christian Reconstruction 101. I'm your host, Jeremy Walker. And on Christian Reconstruction 101, our goals here are to bring people back into an understanding of Orthodox Christianity and what it means to be a Christian Reconstructionist. I think the term has been lost, even for the short time from which it was kind of developed back in the early 1970s and 80s and forward. R.J. Restuni is considered to be the father of the Christian Reconstruction movement. A lot of people misunderstand what that means, and that's part of what we want to do on Christian Reconstruction 101, is reestablish that meaning. And if you've been listening to this so far, you should have already gotten the idea that Christian Reconstruction really isn't something new. It's not a form of denomination or a sect or a group. All it simply is a movement, very similar to that of the Reformation. And that's all it really is, Christian Reformation or Reconstruction. We're going to go ahead and continue our discussion on R.J. Restuni's book, The Institutes of Biblical Law, Volume 1. We've kind of gone over a couple times already on these episodes we've started that you can find this book on the Chalcedon Foundation website at chalcedon.edu. You can also purchase the book there or read it online. If you're a Kindle person, you can go to Amazon and look up Institutes of Biblical Law, Volume 1. You can also purchase a copy there. We're moving through the introduction here, and we're going to go ahead and continue. And our hopes here are to introduce people to the works of R.J. Restuni, and specifically this volume here, The Institutes of Biblical Law, or the beginning or foundational place to start. We're continuing on the introduction here on the second segment of it, called The Law as Revelation and Treaty. We're going to begin with quotes. I'm also going to go ahead and begin, as we're giving out these quotes, some ideas about how to further understand what Restuni has written here in his book, The Institutes of Biblical Law. So let's go ahead and begin. Here's a quote. Law is in every culture religious in origin. Now, this is a very important quote. Most people do not get or understand this whatsoever, that law is religious. For some reason, people tend to think that law, wherever it's coming from, is just a source that is not necessarily a religious source. But let's take somebody who is claiming to be an evolutionary person, a scientific background, and they have a society. Well, where do they get their law from? Where do they determine their morality? You're not going to go outside and pick up a rock and find morality underneath a rock. It is a concept of what is right and what is wrong, what is just and what is unjust. If there is a moral law that is broken in the civil realm, there's a punishment that accompanies the breach of this law, let's say murder or theft. But you can't go outside and find it. You can't go out in the world, the natural world, and find these out there underneath a rock, or you can't study animals to find out what the punishment for murder should be. It's not naturally occurring. Morality, law, justice, judgment. Because the reason is it is a judgment from a person. Someone or something is saying something is good and something's not. Now, if you were going to look at America today, the source of law, its religion, is statism, because Americans in our modern time, especially even Christians, view law as being the source of law being in the state itself. And so we're going to go ahead and continue, but this is an important point that Restuni is talking about here, that law is religious. No one can claim whatsoever that they are non-religious people. If you believe something is right, if you believe something is wrong, if you believe that something should be punishable by law, then you have a religion of some sorts. We'll get further into that. Another quote from Rushdie in this segment is, "Accordingly, a fundamental and a necessary premise in any and every study of the law must be, first, a recognition of this religious nature of law." So if you're going to study law of any sorts, you have to study the source of it, and it is a source or religion. Where does it come from? Christians never ask themselves this question. Where does their morality come from? Now, we'll get into some other stuff in a minute about the source of morality, but Christians are very confused by this subject. Most of them reject the Old Testament. When they reject the Old Testament law that God's given, some of them try to hold on to it's a moral law. You know, they still believe that murder is wrong and theft is wrong. But then they disagree with the judgments that God gives, or what should be the punishment for judgment, murder. What should be the punishment for theft? What should be the punishment for whatever it might be? And so they try to hold to or cling to this idea that the moral law or their, you know, kind of what you should hold to for personal morality is good to come from the Old Testament. But for the civil government, this shouldn't be where they draw their judgments from. You can't go to the Old Testament and go, well, God said a murderer should be put to death by two or three witnesses. Well, that shouldn't be the judgment. The civil realm could kind of come up with their own. So there's a lot of ideas here, but you have to, if you're going to start the concept and the idea of law, everything is religious. You can't get away from it. Continuing on here, it says, quote, "Second, it must be recognized that in any culture, the source of law is the God of that society. If law has its source in man's reason, then reason is the God of that society. If the source is in oligarchy or in a court, senate, or ruler, then that source is the God of that system." Now, this is very important. I was talking with a person recently about this subject and about where do they get their laws, where do they get their judgments from. And the person became very, very evasive. They did not want to answer the questions because as soon as you start asking, well, where do these judgments come from? You start to peel back the veneer that people have that's saying that they don't have another God before God. It's the basic breach of the first commandment, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Who do you look to tell you what is right and what is wrong? Who does the family look to tell them what is right and what is wrong? Who does the church look to determine what is right and wrong? Who do the civil governments and magistrates look to determine what is good, moral, right, wrong, and what is just? Now, the person I mentioned earlier who said that we should, on a personal level, hold to God's commandments for kind of a personal morality, disagreed with following the judgments of God or the punishments of God. Those didn't have to be for our modern times. Those are just for ancient Israel, but not for us today. But when pushed to answer the question, if someone stole $200 from you and they were caught, what should the punishment be? Because on the one hand, the person could hold to the concept that on a personal level, theft is wrong. So this person shouldn't steal on a personal level. But all personal morality is backed up by civil sanctions and civil punishments. Otherwise, there's no reason to have personal morality at all. In other words, who cares if somebody is going to personally not like to steal, but if nothing's going to happen to them, the people that want to steal can steal. On a personal level, you might be against murder, but if somebody else is not against murder, they're just going to murder because there is no hindrance. There is no punishments. There's no deterrence. Because law, civil law, backs up personal morality. You can't separate the two. Now, the person I was talking to was trying to do that. When pushed and asked the question, what would be the punishment on the civil realm in the courts today? If someone stole $200 from you, what would be the just punishment for them? The person wouldn't answer it because, of course, at this point, they're saying they don't have to follow God's law, which would be restitution and is based upon what was stolen and how much was stolen. If it was two times restitution or four times or fivefold, various forms of restitution, but the prescription by God is restitution for such a theft. Now, of course, by getting rid of that concept, by saying, well, we don't have to follow God's laws and judgments anymore, we created them ourselves. They're then peeling back this veneer and showing that the God that they have is either self, where they can come up with their own laws, or the court system, their status, once again. Now, this makes people, especially churchmen, very uncomfortable because it reveals to them who their God is. Because their God, as we find here, the source of law. Who is the source of law? And if you find the source of law, who gets to determine what is right, what is wrong, and what the punishments are for violation of those commandments or whatever they might be, the good things versus the bad things? And you can't separate the two. You can't separate personal morality from civil sanction. The society backs up that it is moral not to harm people, and it's evil to murder people, with a civil sanction, according to God's law, with the death penalty. Why is it you should not murder somebody? Why is it you should be deterred from doing that? Because if you do, you yourself are going to be killed. There's a death penalty attached to it. There is a deterrent to keep the commandments. There's something that pushed to you to keep them and something to avoid, which is why you don't do it, a deterrent. Moving on, these are all important points to remember, and I want to try to point out these things as best as possible, as quickly as possible, because when you're reading Restrenine and he's making these points, you really have to kind of fill in the blanks sometimes, because he's not going to always spell it out. He's doing a great job of bringing these very dense topics into focus, and it's something that you have to try to focus on. Okay, moving on here, we want to move to a third point that Restrenine is pointing out in this section. Quote, third, in any society, any change of law is an explicit or implicit change of religion. Now, this is a very important point. He doesn't make the connection here because, of course, he's trying to point out this very dense and very important topic here. But people, whenever they're changing their law system, are changing their religion. When you want to draw these connections, this is the important hostility you'll see within the churches today. And the reason why people are hostile to the law of God is because they are already loyal to another law system, which means they have another God. And what we're talking about here isn't just statism, but mostly is humanism. And humanism, of course, is man, the original sin, determiner of right and wrong. So whenever somebody comes in, even in the church, and tries to say that God's commandments are our standard, there is a pushback from this, because whenever you're setting the standard up, you're warring with or trying to change these people's religion. Now, they would like to, on the veneer, say that they love God. They love to say that God is the God that they, their Lord and Savior and all the rest. But whenever you come into this, there's a hostility to God's law being taught in the churches. Reading that again. In any society, any change of law is an explicit or implicit change of religion. So whenever the law of God is being taught in the churches, and why there's hostility there because the religion of that church, religion of that family, religion of that person is not to God. That's not their authority. That's not where their fidelity is to. It's to something else. That's why they're hostile to the law of God. Otherwise, it would not be something that would be so controversial in the church, because they see it, if once again, explicitly or implicitly, a change of their religion. So whenever you're going across these subjects and you see this push, and you'll see this attachment, people have an absolute aversion they have to God's law, an attachment to man's law, it's because they are humanist 101. They are loyal to man being the determiner of right and wrong. And it's a very hard thing to pull people out of. But this point right here that Restrenine makes is a very important one. And you won't understand it until you look back, and you won't understand why the churches today are so hostile to God's law and God's commandments. But this point really explains it well. They're hostile to God's commandments being taught because it is an explicit or implicit change of their religion. And since they're not faithful to God's commandments and God's law, that means that they have another God. Once again, it could be the church, it could be the state, it could be self. But in any event, whatever it might be, it is humanism. There's lots of different flavors of humanism, but they're all humanism. So this is a very important point that Restrenine points out. There's another point he makes here, quote, fourth, no disestablishment of religion as such is possible in any society. A church can be disestablished and a particular religion can be supplanted by another, but the change is simply to another religion. So going from one religion to the next is possible, but you can't get rid of religion. You can't become religiously neutral. There are those people out there that claim to be atheists, that we're going to be non-religious, or people against religion, people against fairy tales and all the rest. But then, of course, they go ahead and spin fairy tales. You go into evolution, you can go into people deciding that they can be whatever they want to be. One moment you can just decide which gender you are. Where do these ideas come from? Well, these are beliefs. A belief is a religion. So anytime you change from one religious belief to the next, you're changing religions. You can't ever do away with it. You can't ever say, we are only facts-based people. Well, that's not how it works, because there is no such thing as a facts-based is murder right or wrong. That's a belief system. Or is adultery or fornication right or wrong? Or anything else governing sexuality and all the rest? These are religious beliefs. I believe this. So every time you change something from one standard to the next, it's always religious. You can't ever step outside of it and become a outside party that has no religious beliefs whatsoever. You're just going to follow the facts. That's not possible, because everything a person thinks about when we're concerned the morals or morality is always a religious concept. So you can change your religions, but you can't ever disannul or get rid of religion. So the people who are claiming to be non-religious are actually religious as well. They're just a form of humanism where mankind, man's ideas, man is the standard. So it's not really that he has these facts out there, but these are whatever I determine to be right and wrong. These are my beliefs about what is true and what is not. Another point he makes is fifth point here. There can be no tolerance in any law system for any other religion. Toleration is a device used to introduce a new law system as a prelude to a new intolerance. So in other words, basically it's real simple here. The point he's making is that there is no such thing as tolerance of another law system or of another religion. Anytime somebody says we need to be more tolerant, we need to be more tolerant, it just means that they are trying to subverse and supplant whatever is the current norm for something new. And then once the new norm is set, then it is absolutely intolerant. Well, you see that in the new modern times we're having today. There was this little push here with we should allow people to really be what they want to be, do what they want to do. But then as things became norm, people's different ideas about sexuality, different drives about what people call themselves, what they are, all the rest, now all of a sudden, you can't speak against it. If you speak against it, then you are somehow a horrible person. It became a new intolerance. The rest of you is hitting the point dead on here. So when people are devoted to something, they have to be completely devoted to it. If for some reason people are preaching tolerance towards other things, it's only because they're trying to change the current norm for a new standard. And the new standard will then be an intolerant standard. So it's never tolerance versus intolerance. It's always intolerance. Always intolerance for another law system or another religion. The only difference is when there's tolerance preached, it's someone trying to be subversive. So their form of law, their form of religion, their form of intolerance can be the norm. So these are important points to pay attention to when you're reading Restunion. Another quote here is, every law system must maintain its existence by hostility to every other law system and to alien religious foundations, or else it commits suicide. So basically it just means that all religious systems, all law systems are always at war with each other. This is why people can't come together, because you can't. You're always at war. These my ideas versus yours. Whenever you have the ideas of the biblical foundation, God's law, it can never be at peace with someone who says that God's law is not the standard, but they make it up, or the state makes it up, or the church makes it up. There's always going to be warfare, because there can't be any tolerance. Anybody who tries to find a middle ground is going to commit suicide, as Restunion states here. This is what it means by churches and Christian families have all committed suicide for generations. They've taken their kids, given them to governmental schools, trying to find a middle ground where this is just education, it's not really religious. Well, everything is religious, especially education. And because they try to find this new middle ground, whereas a humanistic education, non-religious education, they've committed religious suicide. And once again, they've subverted Christianity that they claim to hold to, and now, of course, their children now belong to a brand new religion, have been indoctrinated to this brand new religion, and will be dedicated to this new religion. The family and the churches have committed suicide, religious suicide, by doing this, because you cannot have peace. You cannot have this integration. It is at war with each other. In other words, there can't be oil and water. They just don't mix. You can't mix humanism with fidelity to God. They don't mix at all. And to give up means to give in entirely. Well, this is why Rushdie says here, it's like committing religious suicide. Another point Rushdie makes here is that, quote, the biblical concept of law is broader than the legal codes of the Mosaic formulation. It applies to the divine word and instruction in its totality. This means that the entire Bible is law. Whenever somebody says, well, how much of the Bible is law? All of it. The entire Bible is law, his law word. That's why I like that terminology whenever people utilize it, the law word of God, because everything is law. Whenever God tells you, thou shalt not kill, that is law. Whenever God came to Abraham and said to go sacrifice your son, that was law. If Abraham was to disobey God at that point, he would be in disobedience to God. Everything throughout the Bible, everything is law. And that means also for this, whenever God tells parents to educate their children, to always teach them the word of God, when they rise up, when they lay down, all the rest from Deuteronomy, they are then violating God's law because they're failing to do what God has said in his law word. You can't toss out the law because the entire Bible is law. It's all binding by God. Another section that Rushdie mentions here, quote, the law is the revelation of God and his righteousness. There is no ground in Scripture for despising the law. Neither can the law be relegated to the Old Testament and grace to the New. Now, the first part there is that the law is revelation of God and his righteousness. This is what righteousness means. Whenever somebody says the law of God, well, we're so glad the law of God has gone away with, they're saying that they're so happy that God's commandments and God's law is in no effect for them because they find fault with it. They don't see it as righteous, as David said throughout the Psalms. They view it as evil, and they view it as evil from their basis, from their religious standpoint, which is humanism. And this is why they find fault with God. Because if they viewed it from the right perspective, they would say that God's law is righteous, how to live. This is what we should do. This is righteous for society to do. What should happen to a person who murders somebody? What should happen to somebody who steals from you? What should happen to somebody who lies? All the rest of the laws that goes with it. Every law, every judgment, everything God said is righteous and good, and we are supposed to say amen to these things. Now, if you can't say that, then you're saying that God's law is unrighteousness. And this is a problem. This is humanism. Because you cannot, as Rushdie is saying, you can't say, well, we're despising the law. Well, as soon as you despise the law, you despise the one who gave the law. You're saying that God's judgment is bad. And I actually had somebody say that recently to me. I heard him say they're talking about the responsibility in any court case for there to be two or three witnesses before the account could be proven to be true or false. Let's say, let's just take murder, for instance. The case is somebody comes up and says, I saw so-and-so murder somebody. Well, unless there were two witnesses or three witnesses, one witness was supposed to be completely discounted. Not listen to this person whatsoever, cannot be tried, nothing. Now, people, of course, had a problem with this. They despised this idea of this requirement for two or three witnesses because they could improve upon it. So they despised God's law, thought he had bad judgment, and therefore one witness should be enough. Well, why would God do that, or this law, or that law? Why would God say this judgment? The problem is they're finding fault with God. They're despising him, and they're despising his law. And that's the point that the Rushdie is making here. You can't relegate the old and the new and say, well, the Old Testament is law, the New Testament's grace. It doesn't work that way. Somehow, in our modern times, we're in the New Testament, that now all of a sudden the commandments of God have no meaning for us. Well, what that means is we've changed our foundation of law. We've changed our God. We've already mentioned at the beginning of this episode here that where the source of law is, that's your God. So if you get rid of God as your standard, because, of course, the Ten Commandments and the law of God are no more effect for us, no more guidance for us personally or for society. Well, who's the God now? It might be the person individually, or most likely it's just going to be the government, or it's going to be the people. But it's not going to be God. So you've changed your God. Whenever you say that there is no more God anymore as far as the commandments are concerned, God has no more law for the New Testament, then you're saying we have a different God. Now, that takes a lot of shapes and forms, but let's continue. Another quote, Judaism had made the law the mediator between God and man and between God and the world. It was this view of law, not the law itself, which Jesus attacked. This is just real simple, and this is the Bible is very clear on this. The law of God is not your mediator. It's not something you can keep in order to be righteous before God. Christ is the mediator. He is the Savior. No one can go and keep those commandments. They can't look to the law as a form of salvation. And that's the main problem. Augustine points it out here. Another quote is, as himself the mediator, Jesus rejected the law as a mediator in order to reestablish the law in its God-appointed role as law, the way of holiness. Now, this is different. The law is not your savior, but it is your way of holiness. It's your way to live. Now, what it means is this. You're saved by God. Jesus died for you. You're a convert. But now you have no guidance on how to live. You have no way of holiness. You're told repeatedly to have good works, but you have no guidance on what those good works are. This is what happens when you reject the law. You become blind men. When blind lead the blind, they both fall in the ditch. And that's why the churches today are full of blind men and all the congregations are in the ditch. That's why this book is so important, Institutes of Biblical Law. It's to give eyes to those who have been converted by God and to teach them how to live. This is your standard for living, not your standard for salvation. Christ is your standard for salvation. But how are you supposed to live? And that's what this one's all about, this book. Another quote, in the law, the total life of man is ordered. There is no primary distinction between the inner and the outer life. The holy calling of the people must be realized in both. This just means very simply is that you can't separate the two. You can't say, I love Jesus, but then break his law. It's that simple. You know a person by their works, by what they do. A person's actions change when they're converted because they go from a covenant breaker to a covenant keeper. Well, what's the covenant? A law breaker to a law keeper. What's the law? How do you know a person has been saved? Because they go to church or because they start keeping the law? And the answer is real simple. They become a law-keeping people. Another quote here is, the third characteristic of the biblical law or covenant is that it constitutes a plan for dominion under God. God called Adam to exercise dominion in terms of God's revelation and God's law. This just means how we are supposed to govern and order things. That's what dominion really means. It's being ambassadors for Christ in this world. Well, ambassadors, they stand for a kingdom. They stand for a law. In fact, whenever you have all these different embassies all over the world, you know, these foreign embassies and foreign ambassadors, wherever these embassies are at, it is foreign soil. And that means on these foreign soils, there is a new governance, a new law. And while you're on that foreign soil, you have to keep the laws of that king, of that lord, of that place. And so as Christians, we're supposed to have godly dominion. And we're saying, in our spheres, in our realms, God rules and reigns. In my home, God rules and reigns. So in your home, the outside people, then the outside of the church, outside Christianity, you might have a different law source. You might have a different Lord in your home. But in my home, that's not the case. In your churches, you might have a different law, a different Lord. But in my church, we have God and his commandments. That is going to be who we stand for. His law rules here. In your business, people might run their businesses differently, but here we are going to reflect God and his dominion, and so my business is run according to God's commandments. So whenever people go around, they see a person individually, they see the family, they see the church, they see the business, whatever they are, even the counties or whatever that might be influenced by Christianity, they say these people are different. The standard of law, the standard of morality is different, and it's reflected by who their God is. If you can't see God's commandments reflected personally or in your family or in your church, in your business or in your communities, then there is a different God, but it's not the God of the Bible. So these things are very important, this concept of being an ambassador, this concept of wherever the Christian is at, this now is where their realm they're going to bring under the control of God. And how do they know if they're bringing things into conformity? Because they have the law. That's what it's used for. Another comment here, and quote, the law is therefore the law for Christian man and Christian society. Nothing is more deadly or more derelict than the notion that the Christian is at liberty with respect to the kind of law that he can have. Now, this is very important. We've been kind of hammering away at this, but this is what Institutes of Biblical Law does, and you need to read this book. But it continues to go through, and this says that the law is for Christian man and Christian society. And that's what Christians do. He's supposed to bring himself into conformity to God, using God's law, his family, his church, his business, and his community. He's supposed to be the salt that the Bible talks about. It is supposed to be the one who goes out there and says, wherever I am, people see Christ. Now, what does that mean? It's not your smile. That's not how people see Christ. It's not all the amens that you have, but it's how you live. It's how you live, and that's what's reflected into a godly man, a godly family, a godly church, a godly business, and a godly society. The laws that are in effect in that realm. And the law of God is what we utilize to organize the Christian man, the Christian family, the Christian church, the Christian business. And yes, we start to influence society so it becomes more Christian. And we use the law of God for that. Now, I had some people say, well, the law of God was only for ancient Israel, not for us today. We can't utilize those for modern day stuff. Well, okay, let's go back to what we said before. Let's take the murderer, for instance. What is the concept of murder? Should it be wrong? Well, why should it be wrong? Well, because people should just know it. Well, not everybody agrees that murder should be wrong. Some people think that murder is okay. In fact, if you go into a lot of different of the ideology, socialism, communism, all the rest, murder is perfectly okay. So murder is not just known by everybody that it's wrong, but it is a Christian concept. Now, people might have a humanistic concept to that as well. Now, that's just a different rival thing. So what? People have the same idea that murder is wrong. But what's the punishment for it? And then who set that standard? The people? God? So this is what we're talking about here. How are you going to organize it? What is the God of that society? Who gets to tell you what is right, what is wrong, what should be promoted, and what should be hindered? What should be stopped? What should be punished? And what should the punishment be? All these concepts and questions are very important that cannot be answered without God's law. A couple more here before we finish up. Another quote, two Reform scholars in writing of the state declare, it is to be God's servant for our welfare. It must exercise justice, and it has the power of the sword. Yet these men follow Calvin in rejecting biblical law for the common law of nations. But can the state be God's servant and bypass God's law? And if the state must exercise justice, how is justice defined, by the nations or by God? There are as many ideas of justice as there are religions. And this is what it comes back to again. People will not be completely uncaring about the idea of justice. They have opinions. They turn into their news, they turn on their TV stations, they turn into their internet, they read the local news. Everybody has an idea about elections, everybody has ideas and concepts about politics and who you vote for. Just wait till elections come around. Everybody has ideas about all these different concepts. The question is where does their law come from? What's the source of it? If the source of the concept, everybody's running around, the state needs to be obeying God. Well, what does that mean? The churches don't even have God's law. Their families don't have God's law. Why would we expect the state to have God's law? And on top of that, who's to set the restrictions for what the state can do? I mean, who says that they can't tax us to 100% taxation? Who is it that says they can't take your children from you at whim? Who is it they said they can't do whatever it might be? Where are the restrictions that the state has upon itself? And who's restraining it? Because if God is not the standard, if his law is not the standard, let's say the state is the standard, then nobody can tell the state, you can't do that. It is the standard. It is God. So this is what is so important about understanding that the source of law is the source of the person's religion. Because you have to understand this point. Because this is your God. Who determines right and wrong? Who determines justice? Who determines limitations? This is the God of the society. And as you know, no one is above God. So if the God of society is the state, and nobody can tell the state, hey, you're doing something wrong, you have no right to do so, because this is your God, and you must do everything they say. Another quote here is, the question then is, what law for the state? And this is what we're talking about. If a person's against God's law, then where's the standard? Same question I was asking the other person the other day. Well, okay, let's say that we toss out God's commandments, meaning the judgments and the punishments, okay? Well, let's just say the state's still against stealing. Okay, maybe the state is against theft. Well, okay, but what's the punishment for people that steal? What's the punishment for people that steal? We've tossed out God's standard. So the state then, if it is the standard for right and wrong, it can come in and say, well, if you steal $200, we can take your children from you. We can put you to death. We can put you in prison for 25 years. We can take you and we can, you know, make you move states. You're not allowed in this state anymore. We can make you move countries, whatever it might be. In other words, there is no limitation to what it, the state, can determine is the judgment because you've given it up. When Christians give up God's law and God's judgments, it then submits to something else. The problem is getting people to admit that. And they don't want to admit that because they will have to admit that they're not Christian, meaning that they might be professing Christian, but they're not a living Christian or acting Christian. This is why these are subjects are important, and this is why Institutes of Biblical Law is important. Another quote, by abandoning biblical law, these Protestant theologians end up in moral and legal relativism, basically humanism 101. There's a lot of different flavors of it, but it's all humanism. So you can't really have what is actually moral, what's actually legal. You know, this is right, this is wrong. Well, how do you know? The state can change anytime it wants to. After all, the state is God, or the person is God. Who's to say that today the theft of $200 doesn't mean we can't chop your hands off, and tomorrow it's going to be fining you $50,000, and the next year it's going to be putting you in jail for 25 years because you're in moral relativism, legal relativism. Whenever you toss out God's law, you're just left in complete relativism and at the whim of whoever your new God is. Another quote here, for the Bible, there is no law in nature because nature is fallen and cannot be normative. Moreover, the source of law is not nature but God. There is no law in nature but a law over nature, God's law. A lot of people like to argue for that concept of natural law. Where do you find the punishment for murder? Is it hidden under a rock somewhere? No, it's not somewhere. There is no such thing as this natural law concept. It's a humanistic concept, and what they really mean, whenever they say natural law, is natural man's law, whatever he comes up with, whatever his ideas are, whatever the state comes up with. But there is no such thing as natural law. There's no natural morality out there. It's either God or some other God, but it's not naturally occurring. And just a couple more quotes here to finish up this section. Quote, neither positive law nor natural law can reflect more than the sin and apostasy of man. Revealed law is the need and privilege of Christian society. In other words, we need and are privileged to have God's commandments, God's judgments. The Bible talks about this, how God said societies would look around and say that no one has a law as just as God's law that protects people. On the one hand, I was talking to the person about the restriction God has on two or three witnesses. And let's say it's murder. And they're saying, well, that would mean that some murderers are going to get away because, after all, there was no witness to catch them murdering every single person. But they're missing the point when they say, well, God's commandments are restrictive. In other words, because of the two witnesses, some murderers might go free or any other case that you're talking about here. But if there's not two witnesses, somebody who is guilty might go free. Well, yeah, that's actually true. But the problem is not only is it that God has restrictions on how many witnesses there are, but he also has a punishment which is bad enough to scare people not to do those things. It's a deterrent. For the murderer in this case, if you murder somebody, he's dead. He's not going to go to jail for a couple years and get a second chance. He's going to be dead. Dead. There's no second chances where murder is concerned. And throughout the other rest of the case laws and otherwise, there's lots of other commandments that God's given, lots of other judgments that God's given, and they're all used to be deterrents against the people that might do them. In the case of murder, yes, in this case, there is restriction. A person can, in secret, go murder somebody else and not be able to be convicted because of it. Now, the other side is also true. What about the person who is accused of murder but is absolutely 100% innocent? Now, this person is very much going to be protected as well. See, people are going to be protected on one hand from being murdered because of the severe punishments that God has. You're going to be murdered. You're going to be put to death yourself. So this is a deterrent for somebody to go out and murder somebody. Then, of course, there's restrictions on a false witness. So man is fallen, and therefore people are prone to try to get people into trouble. If they could have society kill somebody just by lying about them, they would. So now there's not just one word versus the next, but now you have to have two or three witnesses. On top of that, there's another safeguard as well to injustice. So the second safeguard to injustice is that if the witnesses are false witnesses, and these people are going to have the same punishment they tried to get on somebody else. So if there was somebody who lied about seeing somebody murder somebody, trying to get this person put to death, this person, if found out to be lying, that person would be the one put to death instead. There's lots of safeguards in God's commandments to protect the innocent, to deter those people that would try to harm the innocent, and of course to deter those that would try to hurt innocent people through false witness. There's a lot of protections that God has here, and it's not a surprise at all that God would say that his law and his judgments, that the surrounding societies would be astounded by it and would have nothing but good things to comment on it. But somehow the churches today, they don't view it that way. They don't view God's law as being just. They actually, like the person I was mentioning a minute ago, viewed these things as unjust. They had a better idea. They could have done it better. It's interesting to me that the churches themselves are the ones who despise the law the most. But it's not really a surprise. As we've been talking about here already, those people who give in and are taught a new law, they're having to give up their religion. And the person I was talking to about these types of concepts and ideas, this person was an absolute humanist, now, like professing Christian, of course, but practicing and promoting humanist. They found fault with God's commandments. They found fault with the idea of having it applied today. And they said that is nothing but an unjust judgment. So basically, if they accepted the fact that God's law was applicable to us today, they'd have to give up their humanism, which they can't do. Hence, of course, they're absolutely hostile, as Rushdie mentioned here already, hostile to God's law, because they can't have peace with it, because it would be subversive to their own faith, and their faith is humanism. And of course, the last comment here, and we'll end up this section here, apart from the revealed law, man cannot claim to be under God, but only in rebellion against God. Let me read that again. Apart from revealed law, man cannot claim to be under God, but only in rebellion against him. So anybody who would oppose God's commandments would say that they're no longer in effect to us. They're not claiming to be separate. They're just openly stating that they're in rebellion against it. And this is something that's a problem with Christians today and have been for a very long time. Are we really surprised that the churches are so impotent and the Christians are so impotent to change society? How can they change society when they're in league with it? They don't have another law. They just agree that statism, that humanism, are the sources of law and not God. So yes, they're in rebellion against God. And that's why the Institutes of Biblical Law is so important. So we're going to go ahead and end this episode here that we're talking about here in the Institutes of Biblical Law. This, of course, has been the episode where we discuss, of course, the introduction, the law as revelation and treaty, and made many comments about it, and hopefully this has given you many things to think about where the law of God is concerned. And the most important thing, we want you to be promoted to pick this book up and to read it. The next part we're going to be doing is also in the introduction called The Direction of the Law, but you can pick this book up by going to the Chalcedon Foundation website at chalcedon.edu. And you can also buy the book there. You can read it online for free. Or check out Amazon.com. You can go to their search for Institutes of Biblical Law, Volume 1. You can also find it in Kindle format if that is what you prefer to do. But go ahead and pick this book up. We're going to continue having episodes on this, giving you some things to think about Christian Reconstruction 101. And this is something you should get from this episode, is that wherever the source of the law is the God. And people cannot be at peace with a rival religion or a rival moral law structure. And this is why the churches today, this is why they're primarily so affronted by, so insulted by, so at war with the idea of teaching God's law, God's commandments in their churches, because it reveals that they're really not Christian. They have a different foundation, a different God, and this is why they're hostile. And so I think Rushton does a great idea, a great job of pointing this out. And people need to read this book, because if they read this book, then maybe they can find the direction that they need to go on a personal level, the direction they need to be leading their families in, their churches in, and their communities. So thank you again for listening to us today, and hopefully you'll tune in next week for the next section of Christian Reconstruction 101.
Thank you for listening to this lesson of Christian Reconstruction 101. Now it's time to put your faith into action. And don't forget to visit ReconstructionistRadio.com to download your favorite audiobooks and to listen to all the other podcasts that we produce.